God has really blessed me. You know, he let me work in D.C., let me work with EIB in Hollywood, in Silicon Valley. And he's shown me through all those experiences that there is one problem and one solution, and that's why we do this show.
Welcome to A Disciple's View with Todd Herman.
Well, the God of the universe created the world. He didn't snap his fingers or wink his eye. The Lord spoke. He said, let there be light. Because we believe, we speak about the happenings in this world, mindful that our true home is with Jesus Christ and his kingdom. I'm Todd Herman. Welcome to A Disciple's View. We don't talk sports here often. I'll mention CrossFit because it's what I do. I don't hunt and I don't fish and I don't have a man cave. And so CrossFit's kind of, that's what I do for a hobby. It's what I do for fun. And that involves friends as often as possible. Often it's an activity I undertake on my own in training because not everyone wants to train at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I'm not really talking sports when I talk about Caitlin Clark. I'm talking about something that's cultural, but it's something that's been an infection culturally. You've heard of the idea of a social contagion, right? It's a social contagion that had caused so many girls to come out and suddenly announce that they're boys. That was a social contagion. And social contagions can be very, very profound, and they can be very, very powerful. And in the case of these girls who said they became convinced that they were boys, they confronted a society that's early on was told there was nothing else to do but say, yes, you are. Praise God for the changes now, where there's a lot of people recognizing that, no, you're not, and you cannot become one. We saw the Supreme Court ruling the other day. Praise God, in the state of Tennessee, they've been allowed to ban the chemical and surgical, it is mutilation of children. So we can see that, but these social contagions drove this. And when a social contagion takes place, the lack of logic and empathy becomes eminently clear. And this happens in this particular social contagion with Caitlin Clark. So Caitlin Clark is a WNBA basketball player. By just about every single measure, Caitlin Clark is the most successful WNBA basketball player in the history of the league. This is a league that has struggled to rise above paying their players even $100,000 a year sometimes. And it's not because they don't want to. Even the NBA has reached in to help the WNBA. It's because they don't make that much money. And often their players fly commercial, poor things. I mean, you're getting played to play a game. Caitlin Clark owns most of the records that matter in basketball. And she has sustained most of the serious fouls, the vast majority of the serious fouls. And it had been that this had been black players obviously assaulting Caitlin Clark. These aren't just fouls. They are clawing her eyes. They are tripping her. They're pushing her down. There's been times where it looks like she is actually punched. Now, there is, and some, my wife has reminded me that there is a mean girl phenomena. My daughter has reminded me, Dad, there's a mean girl phenomena. Please don't make too much of this. So I hope I'm not. But I just watched a video of Caitlin Clark simply playing basketball, not fouling anybody. And a fellow white player reaches out and claws her eyes. And it slowed down. You could watch the video. There's no attempt made to grab the ball. This is a stabbing in the eye. And when that happens, Caitlin is, it's a foul. And she loses track of the ball. She stands up and this girl chest bumps her. Another girl rushes in and chest bumps her to the ground, to the floor rather. One of Caitlin's teammates finally steps in to say, stop, stop. Caitlin's teammate has been fined. There's something called an enhanced foul in the WNBA. This is when it's so serious that it is not simply a foul on the court. It's enhanced. It has intent. It's harmful. It's enhanced. Caitlin Clark has been the recipient of most of those enhanced fouls. But in this case, we're not talking any longer about fouls. We're talking about assault. Why? ESPN made an attempt to make Angel Reese, who is another player in the WNBA, and I'm speaking from statistic here. I'm not speaking from opinion. I don't know basketball. I know football and I know wrestling because I played both of them. I played a little tiny college football. I studied the game. I don't know it like I used to because it's changed so much. I don't know wrestling like I used to because these guys are so much better movers. Now, but I know the fundamentals. I only know what looks like a missed shot, and I understand what a foul is or to double dribble or to travel. I know the basics of basketball, so I can just consult the statistics. Angel Reese was not a competitor for Player of the Year. She was not in the same universe as Caitlin Clark, but ESPN tried to make her that. Now, Angel Reese might be doing something here. She's had confrontations with Clark. Her team had confrontations with Clark. A whole bunch of these fouls occurred this way. Angel Reese might be doing a thing where she's choosing to be the bad, quote, girl of the WNBA. That's a reasonable marketing perspective. But of course, it has to be race. Caitlin Clark is white. And of course, it has to be race. So I said this wasn't a sports commentary, and it's not. It's a social one. The WNBA has not been a basketball league. The game is a byproduct. The WNBA was born as a political entity and a grievance entity. This I remember. Because when the WNBA came into existence and was launched as a league, we were living in Seattle. And it happened that I knew and am no longer friends with, and that's been made clear to me, one of the women who was one of the initial investors, an utterly brilliant woman with whom I worked at Microsoft. We had started as, I think, enemies. We became frenemies. And then after a time, she and I actually began working fruitfully together. She would have me come and speak at her events. I had her speak at mine. She brought me into strategy sessions with her team. I brought her into mine. And it became fruitful and, frankly, fun. Brilliant woman. So she purchased a part of the team as one of the initial investors. And by virtue of that, I got some free tickets. She was, I'm not going to say her name because it's a private matter that we're no longer friends. And it has to do with politics, as you'll see. And she sent me two free tickets to the game for me and my daughter. Via email. I thought that was so cool. So my daughter and I went to go look at the game and say, hey, maybe we want to attend this. And what we discovered was that the WNBA was telling us all to wear pink that night. Why? Well, for Planned Parenthood. It was an abortion fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. And I showed this to my daughter, and we were going to take her and one of her friends. We're going to pay for her friend to go since we had two free tickets. And by the way, I'm saying courtside, right on the floor. And my daughter looked at this, and she said, they're killing babies. Why would they do that at a basketball game? Why would they want us to go celebrate killing babies? And I said, do you want to go? Because I don't think I do. She goes, no, of course I don't want to go. That's not basketball. My daughter was a speed skater at the time. She said, do we talk about abortion at speed skating? No. But there was something else. Early on in the league's inception, the women began to talk about equal pay for equal play. Well and good. If your performance is equal to another player and the market dictates that you have a competitive league, then you should get that equal pay. And to some degree, there's a competitive nature to the way athletes are paid, professional athletes. They get to do a lot of rigging of the system. The NFL gets to do this. There's salary caps, etc. They're doing this to create competitive friction. All of that makes sense. But this wasn't about equal play. The WNBA has never come close to the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of worth of the NBA because there are not enough people going to the games. We made a decision on that day to not go to the games. How could we? It was promoting abortion. And then it was promoting so-called trans rights. And then it was promoting special rights for same-sex attracted people. And then it was promoting this socialism cause. And then Black Lives Matter Incorporated. Every time I turned around, the league was promoting something that had to do with what they would say is social justice. And I would say, yes, but always in the terms of grievance. Which brings me back to Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Clark has brought more attention to the WNBA than anything has ever done for the WNBA, because Caitlin Clark is the impact player of female professional basketball. I don't know about you, I never cared about NBA basketball. I was a wrestler and a football player. My dad never watched NBA football or basketball. My family didn't. My uncles didn't. My friends didn't. I didn't care. And then a guy named Michael Jordan came along. And I started to hear this conversation about Michael Jordan. He can float. What do you mean? He can fly. Michael Jordan can fly. Well, people can't fly. Oh, yeah? Have you watched him? Now, I wasn't blind to NBA basketball. My mom's boyfriend, who lived with us for 7 years, he loved to watch the NBA finals. And I thought for a while there were only two teams in professional basketball, the Lakers and the Celtics, and only two players, Magic Johnson and Bird. What's his name? Larry Bird. And I didn't care. Wasn't in my family. I watched the games. I didn't get it. There's a lot of shooting, and I didn't get it. Michael Jordan, I got. Because Michael Jordan could dribble the ball to the foul line, take to the air, and somehow fly through the air and slam that ball into the hoop. I thought, I've never seen anything like this. Suddenly, my friends were watching NBA basketball. And then, yes, he was surrounded by some great players. Michael Jordan was great at assists, great at passes. He was great at bringing other people in, letting them use their skills. But you know at the end, you know when there's 3 seconds left and they all do that insane thing in the NBA where they start the clock and they stop the clock. You know, get it to Jordan, get it to Jordan, get it to Jordan, get it to Jordan. He'll hit a three. He'll go to the post. He'll go high. He'll take air. He'll do whatever it is to win. That's Caitlin Clark. And the league is trying to kill her. These are not fouls. These are assaults. This is not a fair game. It right now is a game where Caitlin expects to be fouled. Now, I am not hoping for this, but I think it's somewhat unavoidable that eventually, God forbid, this ends in a serious injury. Because of the nature of these assaults that have risen above fouls and into assaults. And what is the ownership of the NBA, WNBA doing? What is the management doing? They can't change the culture. It's been built on grievance too long. And then there's this. There's an undertone to this. Well, this latest foul was white players going after a white player. This is this response of the madness of crowds. This is the social contagion. Hey, it's Caitlin. It's okay to take Caitlin out. The refs aren't going to do much if we take Caitlin out. The management's not going to do much if we take Caitlin out. But there's this undertone as well. And I hate to say it this way, but I must speak the truth as I see it. White girls can't jump. Basketball is the realm of black players. There's an undertone to this within the WNBA, the sin of racism. And racism is a sin. Jesus Christ said, in the body of Christ, there's neither Greek nor Jew, servant nor master. Being racist can remove you from God, because God can't stand to be around sin. Now, we can't expect Christian behavior from non-Christians, but we can expect just behavior from the WNBA. And allowing people to attempt to assault Caitlin Clark out of the league, that's not going to sustain itself. We'll come back on the Disciples View. Welcome back to Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. Coming up, we'll get to personal notes, cleanup item, tower babbling, and more. This is a couple different things in this segment. I want to talk about the Make America Healthy Again movements, but I want to talk about this, and I want to be as gentle as I possibly can, but as truthful as I possibly can. It's making doctors care again. And I know for a fact there are doctors listening to this 181 stations on American Family Radio who are going to say, wait. You're not going to say I don't care. Nope, because if that hits your heart and you're saying, oh my gosh, you have no idea how I care for my patients, I believe you. I really do believe you. There is, though, a deep and very, very clear structural lack of caring within the medical community. And man, it's pervasive. And when people become part of a culture, like we just talked about the WNBA, and this grievance culture as I see it, that has allowed the cash cow, that's a terrible thing to say about a woman, the top earner, or the top source of revenue for the NBA, WNBA, is Caitlin Clark by a long, long shot. More people tune into her and her play than anyone else in that league has ever seen. Statistically dominant just across the board, and she's being assaulted. It's not fouls. I mean, they're fouls, but they're have risen, I think, to the level of actual criminal assault. And that's a cultural thing. And the WNBA is apparently struggling with how to approach that culturally because they're not making any changes to protect Caitlin. Well, such as it is in the medical establishment, there are, I'm sure, people in the WNBA players who are deeply bothered by what's going on with Caitlin Clark. I'm sure Caitlin's parents don't like it. I'm sure many of Caitlin's teammates can't stand it. But there's a coldness and a callousness to this, to the culture of the WNBA, which, as I made the case last segment, was a culture created with grievance in mind. Well, it's a different form of lack of empathy, lack of caring in the medical establishment. It's institutionalized lack of empathy. It's institutionalized coldness. And again, I want to make very clear, there are medical providers who rise above that. I met a nurse when I was in Tupelo, Mississippi, the headquarters of American Family Radio, this just past weekend, and gave a speech on Saturday, and was privileged to meet a listener who's a nurse. And he explained to me that he's made the career decision to not get involved in anything to do with abortion, won't be on a team, won't be related to it at all. He will not be involved with injecting people with the COVID mRNA gene sequencing devices, even if it leads to his firing, nor will he hide the side effects from people. If patients ask him, hey, do you think I should get these shots? He is saying, no. No, I do not, for the following reasons. So I know there are people in the system who care. Maybe even most people care, but the system doesn't care. And I said I wanted to critique the Make America Healthy Again movement, and I wanted to say, can we make doctors care again? So I'm going to combine those two things. Let me start with this. Do you remember Mary Tally Bowden? So she was a Texas-based physician who did the most audacious thing. She decided to save her patients using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Well, she recently wrote an open letter, and I'll probably get into this in more detail, this letter, tomorrow. It's an important letter, but I'm going to skim the surface of it and get into it tomorrow. She has called out RFK Jr. And some of the people who work with him, like Dr. Macri, for not bringing the COVID shots off the market. And she goes through many of the reasons. And in fact, I know I'm going to dig into this much, much deeper tomorrow. In fact, I'm going to do a whole segment about making doctors care again and how we could get that done tomorrow. I find this so serious because we are not seeing what we hoped we'd see from RFK Jr., which is the withdrawal of these shots completely from the market. The institutionalized lack of caring is indicative of an environment where people are continuing to give these shots out knowing they don't work. knowing it. That's institutionalized coldness. It does not get any more clear, though, than in the cases of the hospital protocols around COVID. I will not fear that there's been any justice on this earth. I know that justice is coming eternally. I know that God is bringing this justice eternally. I know that when God says a thing will be done, it already has been done. We can count on that. I rest assured in that. But I want justice on this earth for the hospital protocols. Right now, the jury trial for the Scott Sheriff family is going on. Grace's family, Grace, and I've told you about her. She was 19. She had Down syndrome. And I'm going to go through the steps because I went and looked at this. I looked side by side at the steps of what was done to Grace and what was done to a gentleman whose wife, Stacy, took him to the hospital, step by step, same steps. Stacy's husband was sick and they were getting ready to go on a trip. Had a little bit of an elevated fever. This was in the time of COVID panic. So Stacy took him to the hospital. Grace was feeling a little bit sick. A little bit of a fever, so Grace's parents took her to the hospital. When Stacy took her husband into the hospital, she went in with some very clear demands. No remdesivir, no sedatives, no ventilator. When Grace's dad took her to the hospital, he didn't have those demands, as I recall, but he was watchful over them. He's a very smart man. Stacy's husband got into the hospital and they immediately tested him for COVID. Grace got into the hospital and as I recall, they immediately tested her for COVID. In both cases, they found COVID. You can find COVID in a grapefruit with a PCR test. I'm not being hyperbolic. I'm not being absurd. People have used PCR tests to find COVID in grapefruits because the PCR test can find something in anything. If you churn up the cycle rate high enough. So, having found COVID, Stacy's husband was brought into the hospital. We're going to bring him in. He's going to be inpatient care. They brought Grace in for inpatient care. Now, knowing that Stacy had said no ventilator, no remdesivir, the hospital went to Stacy and said, "We really need to give your husband remdesivir." And she said, "No way are you giving him remdesivir. No, that destroys people's kidneys. He doesn't need that. He's not that sick." Well, he might be. As I recall, in Grace Shara's case, they came and said, "We need to give her remdesivir." For what? Well, it will help her. At each one of these stages, these people were paid. Tony Fauci's organization put a bounty on COVID tests, and you got more money for a COVID positive test, and you got more money for remdesivir, and you got more money for putting people on ventilators. Side by side, knowing that Stacy and her husband didn't want him to be on a ventilator, they tried to tell Stacy he's going to need to be on a ventilator. She said, "What are you talking about? He's breathing perfectly well. He doesn't need a ventilator." In the case of Grace, we need to put her on our ventilator. Why? She's fine. She's breathing fine. Well, she won't be. So better to do it now. No. In Stacy's case, they started to give him a sedative without telling her. As I recall from memory, they did the same thing to Grace. She wasn't scared. She trusted doctors. She was a Down syndrome person with that Down syndrome love for everybody and that wide-eyed trust for everybody. And they were doing this without informing anybody. What does a sedative do? Well, okay, it calms you. You know what else it does? It lowers your blood oxygen level. So they said to Stacy, "Well, like we told you, this would happen. Your husband's blood oxygen level's gone down. We need to get him on a ventilator." No ventilator. In that case, in Stacy's case, they forced him into a ventilator against his will. And he texted her. They didn't know he had his phone. He took a picture of his blood oxygen level, and I think it was at 98%. And he sent it to her and said, they forced me on a ventilator. My blood oxygen was at 98%. It did the same to Stacy, or rather to Grace. Ventilator. Side by side, step by step, step by step, the same exact protocol. At one point, they were lying to Stacy. She has recordings of the lies. She was taping them without their knowledge because that's legal in this state that she was in. And she was getting lied to. Hey, is my husband on remdesivir? No. He's not on remdesivir. You sure? Because we don't want him on remdesivir. No, he's not on remdesivir. Nope. She went home and she called at a different hour with different nurses there. And she asked, she said, hi, you know what? I was just doing some research. And apparently there's this great drug called remdesivir. Do you think we could possibly get that for my husband? This could save his life. And the nurse said, hold on, let me check. And she came back and said, great news. Your husband's been on remdesivir for a few days. They were lying to her. Why? Did they think remdesivir would help a man who wasn't sick at all? Who could have walked out of that hospital with the following advice? Here's a bunch of vitamin C and a bunch of vitamin D. Eat all these pills. Eat 5-10 of these per day. Get a lot of sunlight. Drink a whole bunch of liquid. You're going to be fine. Same thing could have been said to Grace. Same thing. Both of them, in my judgment, were killed. Ultimately, the same way. Same cocktail of drugs. All of this from your federal government. All of it. Financial incentives that loop right back around to Big Pharma that has paid 40% of the bills of the CDC, or pardon me, 40% of the bills of the FDA, 40% of their budget comes from pharma. And in the case of the CDC, bizarrely enough, CDC scientists got to make money off of the patents of pharmaceutical companies. Bizarre, and not have to tell us how much. Both of these cases ended in what I think are at least manslaughter. The Grace Shara case went to the jury yesterday. I just got a note from Scott. On Sunday, Scott's going to be having, oh no, pardon me, Saturday. Scott's going to be having a press conference. They expect to get an announcement from the jury. They expected a jury decision on the 20th. Saturday, the 21st, they're holding a press conference. I wish I could be there in person. I'm going to be there virtually. I texted Scott this morning. I'm going to try to get him on my podcast and on this radio program as soon after this trial as possible. I am voting, I'm hoping and praying for these nurses, doctors, and hospital systems to be found liable for killing Grace through medical abuse, medical assault. I've not been able to be at the trial, but her sister was, Jessica. Grace's sister testified at the trial. And this is Grace's sister describing her begging nurses to save Grace to no avail.
They told me that Grace was DNR, which means do not resuscitate. They told all of us because my parents on FaceTime and me in person. They were saying that she's DNR.
What was your response?
All of our response was that she's not DNR. Help her, save her. We were pleading, screaming, yelling. You got to picture what was happening. This didn't happen in a couple seconds, a couple minutes. It actually went on for almost 10 full minutes trying to get someone to help her, save her. And no one stepped in that room. They literally stood outside Grace's room stationary. They would not move.
There's coldness here. The allegation, as I understand it from Scott's family, is they illegally put Grace on DNR. That wasn't their choice to make. They didn't consult the family. The institutional coldness is that everybody knew. You can't work in medicine at that level and not know what you're doing. So making doctors care again might require inviting pain again. It might require a verdict here that bankrupts doctors and nurses. I don't want that to happen. That's not what Scott's seeking. He doesn't want to see people bankrupted. He wants to see people repent. He specifically asked us to pray for their souls. But the way this has worked with big hospital systems is the same way they're trying to make it work with something else. And it's very, very much related to institutional coldness, institutional lack of caring. I shared with you the other day that there is an effort to modify the genes of organisms that live in soil and to do it in broad scale. I don't think I made this clear enough, and I hope you'll hear this. These big companies like Monsanto that's been bought by Bayer, they're distributing this soil with these gene-modified organisms, which, by the way, will spread through the air, through plants, through animals, into our bodies. Do you know that they're seeking the same exact waivers that vaccine companies have? They know they're going to sicken people. They know they're going to cause cancers. So they want you to be prevented from suing them. That's institutional coldness, cultural lack of caring. It's within their emotional infrastructure. Oh, and just one thing. God was in every private meeting. Everything shouted, whispered in the dark will one day be shouted from the rooftop. Just a quick note to the technocratic medical establishment. God reads your texts. We'll come back on the Disciples View. Welcome back to Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. We'll get to these cleanup items and then the tower babbling and then a personal note. You know who Nate Silver is? He had been the he'd been a political pollster, statistician, and got scooped up by the New York Times. He had a website called 538 and got scooped up, purchased by the New York Times, and then is now, I think, again on his own. He's got a new book out called On the Edge, and I think Nate pretty clearly leans pretty far to the left. I don't think that affects his polling, though, and there's analysis. He's been wrong. I mean, all these guys are wrong from time to time. And maybe this is wrong, but my life experience would say otherwise. He took a look at the difference in happiness between conservatives and liberals. So what do you predict that was? How do you think that came out? He writes this. Okay, not even sure where to begin with this one, but here's an attempt at a deeper dive understanding why conservatives are so much happier than liberals. Mostly looking at how persistent the gap is in a survey rather than extrapolating too much. And overall, liberals, conservatives are 68% happy. Liberals are 53%. Conservative men, 69% happy. Liberal men, 56%. Women, liberals are 51% happy, 66% men. Race, whatever white race means, I don't know what white means. 68%, 52% liberal, white men, conservative, 68% happy. Black, I don't know what that means because black is not a race, it's a color. There are many people with dark skin who are not African, et cetera, but this is the way they want to group things. 68% of black conservatives are happy. 60% of black liberals are happy. Much higher, by the way, than white liberals. Hispanics, 65% of conservatives are happy. 51% of Hispanics. And it continues across the board. Really, there's very few areas in which conservatives are not happier than liberals. And then Nate writes this. One thing I think we can say is that correlation isn't spurious. Age and religiosity matter a lot. Religious people are happier. Younger people are sadder. But the liberal-conservative gap outweighs almost all other characteristics except age. And yep, even it's in income, lower income, below 30,000, conservatives are happier. Above 100,000, conservatives are happier. Protestants, happier. Conservative Protestant versus liberal. Conservative Catholic versus liberal. The closest it gets is in agnostic. 62% of conservative agnostics are happy. 48% of liberals are happy. The least happy people are people who are consider themselves bisexual or other. 35% of liberal people who consider themselves bisexual or other are happy versus 59% of people who consider themselves bisexual or other are happy when they're conservative. So how can this all be? Here is a through line of liberalism that I've observed over the years. We have the capacity to make everything perfect. If we could just stack up enough laws and enough power and government officials, if only people would do exactly what we tell them to do, we could build paradise. No, you can't. That can only happen in the new heaven and the new earth, where only Christians will be, period. Jesus Christ said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets to the Father, comes to the Father, but through me. Only Christians will be in heaven. Now, I just said that there were conservative atheists and agnostics, and they were also happier in here, because one of the through lines of conservatism is government cannot save us. Government can't actually provide anything, because government can only take and redistribute. It cannot create. It takes and it redistributes. A government powerful enough to give you everything you want is a government powerful enough to take everything you have. All of these things are truisms and real beliefs within conservative land. In liberal lands, yes, government should give us everything, but they just won't. And in liberal land, you cannot love a person and tell them what they're doing is wrong. Senator Chris Coons just came out and said, and this is so typical of people who use liberalism or misuse faith as a way to merchandise their liberalism. And he's saying, look, we have to love the sojourner. And he's sort of quoting the Bible, paraphrasing it. We have to love the sojourner and the traveler because we ourselves are travelers. Yes. Yes, you're right, Chris Coons. But love doesn't mean it's okay to steal. I love you, so steal our votes. I love you, so break our immigration laws. I love you, so set up cartel pipelines in our country. I love you, so dig tunnels under our border. I love you, so lie about immigration status. I love you, so come in, lie about immigration status, and get $2,200 bucks a month and $10,000 to show up in this state. No, that's not love. It's pandering. It's helicopter parenting for people who aren't your kids. It's not love. It's not. So in liberal land, they believe the only way to love is to affirm at all things, and we just won't. And if people would just do what the experts say, then we could have perfection. And perfection's within our reach, and we could have heaven on earth if people would just stop driving their cars, if people would just speak the pronouns, if people would just install solar panels, if people would just say that everything is racist, if people would just do this, then we could have heaven on earth. If we could just have a fair tax system, if the rich pay the fair, then we. That's why people are unhappy when they're liberals. Christians, we can look at this and say, we are not citizens here. We are sojourners. There's only one place we'll have perfection. That's in the new heaven and the new earth. And the only way there is through Jesus Christ. And if you're going to get in there by saying, okay, if that's the only way in, then all right, I accept Jesus. No, it doesn't work that way. Accepting Jesus means to love him and then to want more of him and to abide. And if that's a big word for people who are new to Christianity, think of the word abode, a home, making a home in Christ. It's a big, big difference in happiness. On this program, we thank the Lord for placing supposedly wise people on tall towers of shaking sand with our feature called The Tower of Babbling.
You know about the biblical truth of the Tower of Babel. A Disciple's View presents
the Tower of Babylon.
It is not a criminal violation to enter the country illegally. It's not a criminal. It's a crime. It's not a crime.
Three sound bites in today's Tower of Babylon. That's almost always the case. Ronnie Chang, the host of The Daily Show, had some funny jokes about America's 250th birthday parade.
So you agree the whole parade is a terrible idea?
No, I love it. Usually only brown nations get to see American military hardware, and that's outside that window at very high speeds.
It's funny. It was so funny. Oh, I aired, by the way. It was about the Army's 250th birthday. Yeah, we've never had a war between what you would call white people, well, except for the Civil War and World War I and World War II. But yeah, aside from that, you're right, Ronnie. Next soundbite in today's Tower Babbling, MSNBC's Tim Miller had some comments about what is and is not in the American tradition.
If you just look at what happened in the past week, right, and you have military in the streets of Los Angeles over the objection of the governor, threats to jail or tar and feather the governor from the administration, even if they're joking, not in the American tradition.
There are cartoons from the era of John Adams of politicians being tarred and feathered. Literally cartoons. And military in the streets against the objection of a governor. Gosh, that happened when we integrated schools. The military is involved in that. When we were protecting the right of black people to march, military got involved in that. And in this case, we are protecting the right of a country to have a border. Because if you allow anyone and everyone to skip over your border, you don't have one. Last soundbite in today's Tower Babbling. This is an older gentleman, and he's likely joking here. He's beating up and yelling at a Trump doll at a No Kings protest in California. He turns to the camera and he kind of smirks. But his son, it's funny, at this No Kings protest, they had that booth set up with this little doll of President Trump, and you had to give him a nickel to assault the doll. Seems really well balanced mentally, doesn't it? And that's a wrap for today's Tower Babbling.
The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters.
That was the Tower of Babbling on A Disciple's View.
On a personal note today, I was just reflecting on something in regard to being a parent that you can probably relate to this. Recently, I went on this trip to Mexico with my daughter. What a blessing. Praise you, God. Thank you, Jesus, for that opportunity to have that time with my daughter. Oh, praise you, Jesus. And, you know, my wife and I are just rejoicing at this, and I'm thinking about parenting, and I was thinking about some things that my daughter and I talked about on the trip, and they're private, so I won't say them here. But I will just give you this little kind of synopsis. My daughter cares about what I think. And I am so imperfect. I've made such mistakes. I have said things and done things that have hurt people. And I think all of us at some time or another do these things. But it's good to know that my daughter sees in me someone to whom she can turn for some help. Right, and not in rescuing sense, partnering sense. It hasn't always been that way. I remember there was a time. This was such an indicative moment of parenting. This was back when she was speed skating, and we had had an opportunity to go attend an event where Olympians came. My daughter speed skated on these wheels, and incidentally, when I was in Tupelo giving the event, there was a lady who speed skated. She listens to the show. She had me sign a picture of her in speed skates. Yes, ma'am, I do remember you. And so we got to attend this event where there were people who had been speed skaters on wheels and had gone on to the Olympics on ice. Incidentally, speed skating on wheels is a far funner sport, far, far, far more fun to watch. And they showed up at this event for 2.5 days. One of the people who was there was a woman named Brittany Bowe. Brittany had, I think, 3 or 4 gold medals, held a whole bunch of records, still had held speed skating records in on wheels. I think 15 years later, phenomenal athlete. And my daughter got to skate with Brittany because they teamed up teams of kids with these Olympians. Joey Mantilla was there. There was some other really, really famous people there. And so my daughter got to skate with Brittany. And I was watching this race. And there was a girl my daughter had never beaten at this clinic. And they're racing competitively. And I watched my daughter follow this girl on this 5-lap race, 500 meters, followed her on the first lap right on her, on the second lap right on her, third lap right on her, on the fourth lap, she passed her. And I remember this girl's name was Tina. Tina was stunned. And my daughter didn't look back, just dominated the rest of that race. And she skated off the floor and came over to me and said, "I can't believe it. I beat Tina." I said, "Yeah, you smoked her." She goes, "Dad, Brittany Bowe is a genius." "Oh, tell me about that." "Brittany told me there's no reason to try to pass her right away. Just skate really close to her and then just wait for a moment where she doesn't have a perfect turn, because no one has perfect turns. And at that moment, just go then." I held back. Because while I never speed skated, I grew up racing cars. That was one of the first lessons, wait for your moment to pass. I'd said that countless times to her. But Brittany Bowe is a genius. And I remember, praise God, I didn't say anything other than, "You're right, honey. Brittany's a genius." Ah, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Because we believe, we speak. Because he loved us first, we speak his word. We walk in the path of Jesus Christ to make disciples of all nations until God gives us permission to speak again together. May his peace, which transcends all understanding, rest upon you and your families. On behalf of Randy and AFR, I'm Todd Herman, and this has been A Disciple's View.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.